John Major Jenkins is an expert in Mayan cosmology and calendar systems. He has authored several pioneering books and works, including Mayan Cosmogenesis, 2012, that have uncovered the galactic wisdom of the ancient Maya. With careful investigative research, he has reconstructed an entire cosmology that pinpoints 2012 as a time of rare galactic alignment. We're going to talk a lot about that tonight, a time of great opportunity for humanity to achieve a long-prophesized transformation into beings united, once again, with their cosmic heart and source. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. John, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hello, George. I'm doing well.
Good. 6 years. That's way too long, my friend. I'm glad you're back with us now.
Well, thank you for having me.
In the 6 years since we last chatted with you on Coast to Coast, I think Hilly Rose interviewed you. What have you been doing? What's been new in the research and some of the work?
Well, I've been busy. Around that time, it was right after Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 came out, and that was really sort of my breakthrough book. And I had, you know, spent the early 90s, mid 90s researching this unanswered question about why did the Maya pick 2012 to end this big cycle of time. So the book came out in 98, and since then I've been doing conferences and speaking and interviewing, and you know, the follow-up research to that really took me on a global survey looking at many different traditions around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been interested in ancient wisdom and ancient philosophies, and it's really interesting how my pointed research into the Maya calendar led me into basically this global perennial philosophy. So that's what I've been up to. The follow-up book to Maya Cosmogenesis was Galactic Alignment, and that came out in 2002. So I've been very busy.
You know, just this week I was looking at a video from Paul LaViolette, and there you were on one of his videos talking about the Mayans. And there aren't a lot of people on this planet, John, that are experts in this culture, and a culture that I think is so critical to our own future. And I'm glad you were able to do what you do. Was it difficult for you to start researching the Mayan history?
No, it was sort of an interesting, it was almost like a calling. I'd always been interested in Native American beliefs from a young age, and I think I sort of just segued right into it. Back about 20 years ago, I was reading the books of Frank Waters. Of course, he wrote some wonderful books on the Hopi and the Maya,
mm-hmm.
and that triggered my curiosity about getting south of the border, and so I saved up a little money and I planned a trip, and I realized pretty early on that there were Maya people still living in villages in Mexico and Guatemala. So that was one of the things I really wanted to do, was to spend some time with the Maya, find out what was going on. And as I did that, I was reading and doing research and learning more about their traditions and their calendar system. And so no, it was kind of just a gradual deepening process for me.
Do some of the Maya who still exist, do they live like in Cancun and Cozumel and that region? Because I went there about 7 or 8 years ago, and you know, I saw people who were a little different than most of the people who were residing there at the time. They were much smaller, and as you know, John, just in your research, a lot of the stone buildings that the Mayans had built were very small, with small doorways and entrances. Are they possibly some of the same people?
Oh, yeah, for sure, and you're right about that. In the Yucatan, you know, the Maya have really integrated themselves into the modern world to a large extent, especially like around Cancun, and some of them are quite savvy. You know, they're up to date on the internet and all that, and On the other end of the spectrum, further south into Central America, like in the highlands of Guatemala, for example, you do find some very, very traditional Maya villages. Like, for example, one of my favorite places in my travels is a place called Lake Atitlan. It's a beautiful lake in the highlands of Guatemala. It's surrounded by three volcanoes, and there's 12 villages, very traditional Mayan villages around the shores of the lake. And it's funny, they're named after the 12 apostles of Christianity, which is kind of a funny thing. You know, that brings up the whole discussion of how much did the Maya really embrace Christianity. And in fact, what you find is that, you know, they embraced certain elements of Christianity because they saw reflected in those beliefs things that they, you know, spiritual principles or truths that they already sort of accepted. And so in some of these villages around Lake Atitlan, you have Mayan people that are still doing rituals in the sacred calendar, and they haven't even traveled more than 10 or 15 miles outside their village.
Let's, before we really get into 2012 and what it means and to get your take on it, and then talk about some theories that others have thrown out, because I want to get your reaction to that later tonight, John.
Sure.
Let's go back to what life might have been like in Mesoamerica somewhat. What would be a good time period to select to begin to talk about the Mayan Empire at that point? 2,000 years ago, 3,000, how far back do we go?
Well, you know, it's funny because as some recent discoveries in Mayan archaeology, they're always pushing back the dates. It used to be that the Maya Classic period began around 300 A.D., but then they would talk about antecedents to that and, you know, certain characteristics of a culture that defined the early Maya and so on. And so it's really kind of hard to tell, but Mesoamerican history, people, and what we were doing, what people were doing in Mesoamerica, certainly we can go back 5, 6, 7, 8,000 years.
Oh my!
And what we find, one of the most amazing achievements of even say 6,000 years ago, was the taming of corn out of a skinny wild grain called teosinte. And that was sort of like a process of crossbreeding. So they would get, over many, many generations of people, they would get juicier and juicier kernels until we have, like, the kind of corn that we see today. That was basically invented by the early Mesoamerican people over many hundreds and hundreds of years. So even at that early stage of Mesoamerican civilization, we see a kind of genius, I think, at work. And I think that's one of the characteristics of the Maya people. There's a kind of innate brilliance to them.
You know how some of us speculate on the kind of technology the Egyptians might have had when the pyramids were constructed, and you know, we kick it around what might have been there at that time. Did the Mayans, in your belief, did they have any special kind of technology, high technology, or was it still pretty primitive?
Well, back then, you know, say 5,000 years ago, it was primitive by our standards, you know.
Okay.
And they never really had the wheel. That's always something that's talked about. How did they build these huge cities and these huge blocks of stone and move them around without the wheel? But one of the things I like to sort of introduce into the discussion is that, you know, we live in a culture in which technology is really valued as kind of an indicator of sophistication. And certainly that's true. Our own culture has developed some amazing things, you know, computers, space flight, all, you know, the whole shebang. But what I like to talk about is a lot of indigenous and ancient cultures, they might not have had things like, you know, material technologies, but they seem to have perfected, you know, a type of like what we might call shamanism.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, or inner spiritual technologies.
They might not have had rockets, but they sure knew how to travel.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, the kind of, I guess you could call it spirituality or some ability to tap into something that's out there for them. How did they come upon it? Unless someone from above or some higher power taught it to them.
Well, I think you're onto something there. That I think, there's a lot of ways we can discuss this, and there's a lot of things we can focus on. But what I think is so fascinating is that they seem to have come about their knowledge by accessing some kind of higher wisdom. Now, this might have taken place through shamanistic rituals or meditation practices, but it seems like they were opening up their minds to access the what in is called the perennial philosophy, this entire sort of reservoir that exists deep inside our minds, everybody's mind, in which the universal principles that create and maintain the universe can be found. And so when they would do these rituals, these vision rituals, shamans in all cultures, in all times, could access these things and come back with healing abilities and hidden knowledge. And I think that the Maya were really doing something like this in the creation of their calendar systems in particular.
What were their buildings like, John, in terms of the structures and their cities?
Yeah. The buildings were made out of huge stone blocks. And like we find, for example, in South America as well, you have these megalithic structures. In fact, a lot of cultures did this kind of engineering. As you mentioned, in ancient Egypt, of course, the pyramids are probably the best example of that. And another characteristic that the Maya really, a principle, you might say, of the architecture and their building practices is that they would align their buildings and their entire temple sites would be aligned to the stars. And that's really a key to understanding what I like to refer to as Mayan time philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
They had their calendar systems, and they knew how the movements of the sun, the moon, and the planets changed, different rising positions along the horizon throughout the year, and even changing over decades of time. You had, things like the moon, for example, would rise in more northerly positions along the horizon. And so they would track these things, and they would build their structures to mark these kind of extremes. And what this really just speaks to is this beautiful idea, which many ancient traditions ascribe to, is that as above, so below, the heavens and the earth are unfolding in tandem, as it were, sort of the processes in the sky reflect the processes on the earth. And the Maya really saw that. Yeah.
Almost like a partnership of heavens and the planet.
Exactly. And that's a real key to understanding Mayan time philosophy, and it's built into their calendar systems. So, yeah, the buildings, too. When I started doing this research back in the late 80s, and I started reading some of the academic literature. I've always been interested in astronomy myself. I used to have a little telescope, and I'd go out in the backyard with my dad and look at Jupiter, and that was really important early experiences for me, just to sort of have an awareness of the sky. And then I sort of carried that with me throughout my life, where I'd sort of look up and take note of where the moon was and track where it was rising, and just to be aware of that. And so when I was doing my research, there's this burgeoning field of study called archaeoastronomy. And this speaks to your question about how the Maya oriented their sites and what they were doing there. Scholars were starting to notice that, buildings were oriented to the stars. And so this was a great revolution in studying ancient cultures, and it was something that I really wanted to be a part of.
Were these sophisticated buildings or pretty simple?
A lot, what we have surviving, when you go down to some of the ruin sites, the temple sites in Mexico and Guatemala and Central America, they are very striking, you know, just to be there. A lot of people say they have different kinds of experiences at these sites because they were temple sites. Some people call them portals. So originally, they would have been extremely striking because they would have been painted in these bright colors and they would have been visible for, you know, dozens of miles across the plains or from a distant mountain or something like that. So, yeah, they were very ornate. The Maya culture was a very ornamental culture. There would have been a lot of paint and ornate cartouches and so on.
For the period we're talking about, John, what do you think the population was at that time?
Well, let's take as an example the great classic Maya city of Tikal. Tikal was thriving in the 7th century A.D. So at this time, in the Old World, London, for example, was sort of a squalid market town of about 800 people. Now, Tikal and the environs, people, you know, scholars who have studied these things believe that it was about 90,000 to 100,000 people.
Oh, my gosh, that's a huge city.
Yeah,
metropolis. That's a big city for even now.
Yes. And that was just one city of many dozens of cities in the area up there in the Paytain region of Guatemala and across southern Mexico.
What kind of structure did they have in terms of their form of control, government, whatever you want to call it?
Sure. Well, there were no beasts of burden, so you'd have these huge building projects, and somewhat like in Egypt, they would just have manpower, basically. And the type of governmental structure, Mayan culture was shamanistic. So the king was a kind of a king shaman. And this is an interesting type of political organization. It's very different than our political organization today because it's you might call it a theocracy, but that's maybe a little misleading. Basically, the Maya king had a responsibility. He had to, as a shaman, he had to make vision journeys into the cosmic heart and source. This is somewhat similar to like in the far north, like in Siberia, you have shamans who must journey into the pole star. You know, the pole star is seen to be like the cosmic center overhead because all the stars seem to spin around it. So the shaman would make a journey into the pole star and return with knowledge. Now, for the Maya, in Mayan culture, it was believed that the cosmic center was able to empower the king with the ability to sustain the kingdom. So the king had to make these vision journeys into the cosmic center, and if drought happened or if some other disaster befell a city or a kingdom, the king was looked to do something to sort of get things reorganized.
Yeah, save us. He was the one, huh? Were they warring people, John?
Oh, yeah, for sure. The Maya people, you know, they had raids on other kingdoms. We see this in the temple inscriptions. So there's a lot of work being done to decipher the Mayan hieroglyphic writing, and what we find is a great deal of records. I mean, some of these Mayan cities, like Palenque, you have records almost on a weekly basis now that are being translated. So, yeah, there would be, you know, wars on kingdoms, and sometimes these wars would be timed by, like, the movements of Venus, for example.
Okay, John, stay with us. We're going to be right back with more to come, and we're going to get into this understanding of the Maya 2012 date and what this all means. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our very special guest tonight, John Major Jenkins. We'll be back with John as we now talk about the Mayan calendar 2012 and what does it mean to all of us. All right, we're back with John Major Jenkins. John, December 21st. 2012 happens to be a Friday night, and of course we'll be broadcasting the program live. I want you just to circle on a calendar somewhere that you'll at least pop on and be one of our guests that night.
Okay.
All right. I'm making a six-year booking with you right now. Just put it down there, and we're going to make sure you're on the program.
Well, that sounds good. I should start booking events for December, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This date, why is this 2012 date so important, and why did the Mayans pick it?
Well, that is the $10 million question, I guess, huh?
Sure is.
Well, you know, to dive into that, there's a lot of, well, okay. The December 21st, 2012 date, it's the end of a big cycle in the Maya long count calendar. So this brings up the whole question of how are we to approach understanding this? Certainly by now it's clear, that 2012 is a symbol of something big for people. I mean, clearly you've seen that, George, with, all the people you've had on talking about it, and it's definitely gained a kind of momentum in the
yes.
mind of a lot of people. So, you know, what we should remember is that 2012 is first and foremost an artifact of Mayan civilization, and this is a true thing. You know, 2012 as a date, it wasn't invented by any particular writer. It's really an artifact of this Mayan calendrical system. So to sort of get an understanding of how we can come to understand it and what it means, we can sort of trace, like, the journey that I went through with this material was sort of a step-by-step thing where I had to ask the right question, and that led me to an answer, and then another question would occur to me. And basically my approach has been to look at the early Maya site that invented the 2012 calendar. That seems self-evident, but nobody else had taken that approach before. So what I did is I identified Izapa, and it's generally known, scholars, you know, have talked about it, that this early Maya site called Izapa, which is located in southern Mexico, kind of close to the Guatemala border, is the place where this long count calendar system was first put into use.
Now, why is the significance of that? Was it because did they have, you know, the astrologers there of that time period? Why that area?
Well, that area is very, very interesting because Izapa seems to have been situated, and like we were talking about earlier, it was sited to horizon astronomy as well as horizon features, two volcanoes, for example. There's a volcano to the north, and you know, that's one of the main orientations of the site. And what we find happening when Izapa was experiencing its heyday in around the first century BC, that's when the first carved monuments start popping up in the archaeological record. We find, like, the earliest long count monument is dated 36 BC, and so there's about four or five long count monuments that pop up in the decades after that. And so if we look at Izapa, see, this is the key, and I kind of like to go into it slowly because my whole approach is about reconstructing the what we might call the original prophecy, the original teachings around 2012. And what we find in the monuments, there's carved monuments at Izapa. What we find is a coherent and amazing knowledge and teaching and prophecy that we can really sort of tune into. So basically what we find is now to sort of like give it in a nutshell, 2012 is really important because there's a very rare astronomical alignment that is, happens in the years around 2012. And I call this the galactic alignment. And it's basically what's happening is that the December solstice sun shifts. in the sky. It moves very slowly. This is a phenomenon.
Now does this happen every December 21st every year, or is this something that is going to be extremely unusual because of 2012?
It's going to be extremely unusual. It's very clear that the Maya picked 2012 to target this rare astronomical alignment.
Okay.
Now, it's hard to sort of boil it down to 1 year because the phenomenon that's responsible for it is a very slow phenomenon. You know, we might talk about a range of 30 years or something like that. But astronomically speaking, astronomers who have calculated this, 2012 is within this range. And so it's clear that the ancient Maya were tuned into something very profound about, you know, how the sky changes and the kind of, basically this alignment is that we're lining up with the center of our Milky Way galaxy.
We as a planet?
Our planet.
Okay.
Basically what it is that as viewed from Earth, the sun on the solstice will be lined up with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And this only happens once every 26,000 years. So it's caused by precession, the precession of the equinoxes. You know, that's all we sort of really need to know about it. It is a real thing. And the Maya, as being very astute sky gazers, they were aware of this. And that's a pretty profound thing in terms of, you know, an achievement of an ancient people. So, you know, that's kind of like the real empirical thing that happens. And that, to me, is the key to understanding what 2012 is about.
Because from that point, I guess you can look into various different directions. And in one case, John, are we talking about something that could affect people physically and then also consciously?
Yes, exactly. It's a kind of thing that, this is sort of like the opening into a whole realm of, like, galactic research, I think, and it's like a sea change in how we think about our relationship to the universe, because it's a very rare thing, and if we just think about it and sit with it for a minute, we're lining up with the center of the galaxy, the center of our Milky Way galaxy. It's almost like the way that I like to think about it is that it's galactic midnight. In other words, it's a big shift point in the galactic seasons of change that the Earth and our solar system undergo over this 26,000-year period. You know, we can sort of look to just the annual year as an analogy, a metaphor for what's going on.
Can something tragic happen to us around 2012, or do you think it's going to be something else?
Well, this is where it touches upon, when you get deeper and deeper into the research, you realize that this insight that the ancient Maya had, it has to do with cycles and cycle endings, and there are spiritual teachings about the kind of things that happen at the end of cycles. There's like what I call the end times dynamic.
Okay.
And by that, I don't mean like linear time, I mean like the end of a cycle.
And you don't mean Book of Revelation end times?
No, not like that per se. And so to answer your question, we can access these perennial teachings about cycle endings. And what we find is that, you know, it's never graven in stone one way or the other. It really boils down to human beings and how we respond to things that are occurring in the world. So, like, for example, when there's a big change of age, like this is also part of like perennial teachings, it has to do with the world age doctrines and how one world age gives way to another one. And there's this little period, you know, the gap between the worlds, the gap between the world ages. And that's usually a time of great chaos and transformation.
Sure.
And it can affect you know, physical things like we're seeing in the world today. There's more, you know, political unrest, and there's, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes and things going on. But there's also a, like, a spiritual component to this.
Well, it seems to be, John, that things earthwise, earth changes, are building to this 2012 crescendo. I mean, it's, I guess one could call it ironic. One could call it coincidental, which I don't believe in coincidences. But it seems that so many things are happening as we get close to this date. And that I find to be very unusual, because I don't know why.
Well, we can go back to that first thing we talked about, how the sky and the earth unfold in tandem, which is just to say that prophecies in the material world that we see around us, like hurricanes and so on, that's really a sign or a signal that there's a spiritual revolution taking place. So there's a transformation going on. And I think that there can be a lot of consternation about the changes that we see going on around us. But again, it's kind of like, you know, like when winter comes on and the seasons change and everything dries up and
sure.
All the sap retreats back into the roots. Well, if we didn't have a real idea that this is just part of the natural cycles of change and that we just have to sort of understand that it's part of, you know, life and death go together, and there's cycles of retreat and there's cycles of advance, that if we didn't understand that there was going to be a spring dawning at some point, then we would be very, very worried every time that November rolled around, at least for us who live in the northern latitude.
Now, some people say that the Mayans knew that an asteroid was coming, we were going to get hit in 2012. Others talk about a polar shift. So they come up with all these different kinds of theories. I'm not hearing that from you. I don't hear you saying we're going to get hit by an asteroid on December 21st, 2012.
Yeah, and you know, the reason why is because I look at the primary documents of the what I call the original Mayan prophecy, and I believe that the primary documents, the primary statements on what the creators of the long count calendar that gives us the 2012 end date, what they were trying to tell us and what they were trying to leave for us, that's kind of like the purest information we're going to get. And the primary documents are the carved monuments of Azapa. And secondarily to that, the carved monuments of Azapa are basically portraying the Maya creation myth. So we can look to the Maya creation myth, and generally speaking, there's a world age doctrine in there, and they talk about previous ages, but they don't talk about a final end at the end of these ages. It's always about transformation and renewal. And I think that that's something to always remember when we talk about these great changes that are happening, is that ultimately, beyond all the chaos and disruption that we feel and experience happening around us, it's about a transformation. And it's sort of part of the natural cycles of change that we are part of. So it's something that, you know, triggers change, and it triggers evolution, basically. And so the universe is trying to evolve us, and we can either be afraid and clamp up and sort of like, you know, succumb to fear-mongering and curl up and not be part of the process.
Yeah.
Or we have the choice to open up to the unknown and embrace the change, and it'll take us into places that we never dreamed of.
In your opinion, as the Mayans put together this information about 2012, obviously, if this comes in cycles, it comes in cycles of how many years, and did they experience one of these cycles before?
Well, that's a good question. There's big cycles, and then there's little cycles embedded inside those big cycles. So that's the way cycles work. So in a sense, we get a little mini preview of what 2012 is about every time a little cycle ends. And this is really, I'm glad you brought this up, because I believe that this is how we can come to a direct understanding of what 2012 is about. 2012 is a big cycle ending. So what we need to do is to, you know, pick a handy local cycle ending, like, say, the end of a day, midnight, you know, when increasing darkness turns to increasing light, that,
right,
that little magical moment at exact midnight. That's what 2012 is like, but on a much, much bigger level.
Well, I sure hope when you're with me 6 years from now, John, we don't get zapped by an asteroid and just talk to each other going, what happened?
Well, I don't know. Ultimately, I really don't know. But I think that these things like asteroids, I tend to veer away from that because if that's slated to occur, there's not much we can do about it. But then again, it brings up the whole question of, okay, well, if we were all to be blown to smithereens, does that mean that we as beings end? So it brings up the whole meditation on,
good point,
mortality, the immortality of the soul. Is the soul immortal? Maybe these are things that it's probably the most profound thing that a person can do is meditate on the nature of, the immortal soul.
Well, and also, if that were the case, one would have to say, how did the Maya know that this event would occur in 2012? I mean, how did they get that kind of prophecy?
Right, right. Well, I think that because they saw it was anchored to this alignment, which is an astronomical thing that they could calculate.
When we're coming up to the break in a few minutes, but one of the things I want to ask you is, how did they know without telescopes and sophistication where this galactic center was?
Well, there's two quick answers. One is that, you know, just by naked eye observation, they could, you know, we can go out camping and we can look up at the Milky Way and there's a very bright and wider part of the Milky Way between Scorpio and Sagittarius. So just with naked eye observation, they could see that that's a very interesting part of the Milky Way. And so it basically looks like the womb of the cosmic mother, that kind of thing. And the other answer is that with their vision journeys, they, in like an altered state of consciousness, they could directly perceive that part of the sky as being a very energy-dense area of the sky.
Almost like they were doing remote viewing or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
And these people then who worked on this procedure, were they different than some of the other Mayans of the time? I mean, were they the shamans as you talked about?
Yeah, I think so. It was somewhat stratified in terms of who was doing what. In India, or in Hinduism, for example, you had yogis that could make vision journeys and project their consciousness into other times and places. It was a sort of a faculty that they developed. And I think that the Maya were perfecting similar kind of spiritual technologies.
We'll talk when we come back about the Mayans speaking of the possibility of a black hole in the center of the sky. And let's find out if that's true. And welcome back to Coast with our guest, John Major Jenkins. John, our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland, tells us that science believes that there is a black hole in the center of the galaxy. In looking at some of your works, did the Mayans also believe this?
Basically, yeah. The short answer is yes. It's really fascinating because the galactic center, of course, is a key thing for this whole end date alignment. And we also have creation texts that scholars have interpreted. And, one of the things that I bring to the table is sort of a more progressive interpretation of what scholars are putting out there. There was a lot of that kind of thing in my book, Maya Cosmogenesis. In fact, I have an appendix that is called The Black Hole in Maya Creation Texts. Now, the way that this works is that in these texts, it's basically it says that creation happens at the black hole. The glyph literally translates black hole, and that's pretty interesting because 2012 is really thought of as a type of birth or creation. That's why my book is called Maya Cosmogenesis. It's like the rebirth of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, the scientists are pretty sure now that there's a black hole, which is some kind of amazing transdimensional object where space and time breaks down and light can't even escape from it. And it's this magical singularity, you might say. And, you know, the galactic center, the Maya thought of the galactic center as a creation place. And the fact that there's a black hole in there, it just staggers the imagination to think that here it is, right here in the creation text.
So, because, you know, John, I'm beginning to wonder. I mean, here we are, 2005, when most of the information about the possibility of a black hole started popping up. And this is with modern science, with our kinds of technology. Then we're talking about the Mayans from 2,000 years ago believing in this also. I mean, what are the possibilities that we were visited by extraterrestrials and they helped the Mayans, they talked to the Mayans, they showed them things of celestial wonders, and they then started putting this into their texts, their readings, and, you know, in their tablets and whatever form of communications they had?
Well, I suppose that's possible. That's one way to think about it. I also think that if the Maya were accessing a kind of extraterrestrial wisdom or a higher dimensional wisdom in the ways that we were talking about earlier, they could access realms of knowledge that we can barely appreciate today. You know, like the Mayan approach to gathering knowledge about the universe is very different from the scientific method, where it's all about data gathering and making graphs and extrapolating laws and forces from that. The Mayan approach was, as I mentioned earlier, it was more like shamanistic. It had to do with opening up the faculties of the mind to a direct perception of the universal truths. But yeah, that's a really important point that you bring up there. And the whole information around it that I go into in the appendix to my book, it's, you know, there's a couple of different lines of evidence that feed into that too. So it's not, it just can't be a coincidence.
No, I mean, there's something there. What happened, John, to the Mayans? You know, as we were talking about last hour, there are some who have remained, and they've mixed into the Mexican society. But overall, what happened to the civilization?
I personally believe that it's not surprising. Civilizations go through cycles of greatness and decline. Again, this is just sort of the way of the universe. You know, there's periods of increase and there's periods of decrease. And you might sort of think of it as like the fall. You know, in the Western Judeo-Christian tradition, we have this idea of the fall of man or the fall of mankind out of the Garden of Eden. In other words, we somehow got disconnected from being in the paradise place, you know, being in the place where we were bathed in the light of God or the higher wisdom or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, these things, these processes, I think are really just part of the natural cycles of change. So the Maya, you know, generally speaking, there was a decline of the Mayan civilization. It's almost like, you know, the energy that animated the civilization just kind of ran its course. But then again, and I always like to emphasize this, you know, one of the things that led me to Guatemala was the fact that there were traditional Mayan people still doing their things up in the villages. And today there's more than 6 million pureblood Maya still living in Guatemala.
6 million?
Yeah. Yeah. Different Mayan groups speaking different dialects. The Ichil people, the Quiche people are really interesting because they're the ones who preserved the Maya creation myth, the hero twin myth.
Okay, I was going to say, they are aware then of some of their past history.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A lot of the traditions have survived. The 260-day sacred calendar, for example, that's still followed the same day count that was followed. It's been followed unbroken for about 2,500 years.
Are they particularly gifted? Are they particularly tuned into consciousness or whatever might be going on in the universe?
Well, yeah. You know, this is an interesting thing. I go back to some of my early travels to Maya land, and there's a kind of magic that you experience when you are in these villages, and it has to do with the kind of consciousness that is present there. There is almost a kind of very deep intuitive nature. It's almost like they can read minds, or they can read your mind. And I know this might sound a little cliched or something like that, but when you're traveling around, and I did different things when I was traveling too, like I stayed in a village for a whole summer and helped rebuild a school, and I delivered relief supplies to a village in the highlands. So I really had a chance to hang out with the Maya. And the more time you spend, the more you realize that there's just a lot going on there that maybe you're not fully aware of to start out with, but the more time you spend there, you really, it's kind of a world of synchronicities, you might say.
John, do we know if there were other civilizations throughout this planet that also kind of focus in on 2012? I mean, could it have been, the Egyptians?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating thing because this whole galactic alignment thing, you know, to me, that was the key. And again, I also have an appendix in my book that goes into the history of that idea. It actually seems to have been pioneered in, you know, that there is this galactic alignment that happens, and ancient cultures thought that it was important. Mm-hmm. This idea seems to have emerged with that famous book, Hamlet's Mill, in 1969. That's there, why I trace it back to that. But you know, one of the things that's fascinating to me is that other ancient cultures also seem to have been looking to the galactic center and alignments to the galactic center as being really key moments in the history of the Earth and the history of consciousness on this planet. The ancient Egyptians, the ancient Hindu systems of the Yugas. The Yugas are like the world ages, and the Yugas seem to be anchored to this galactic alignment period. And so, yeah, it's almost like this galactic gnosis in our own history of, like, the history of Western science and religion, this galactic gnosis is almost like an unrecognized layer. And that's what I tried to uncover in my follow-up book, which was called Galactic Alignment. Came out in 2002. I looked at all these different traditions around the globe, and sure enough, there was in the symbolism and the traditions, there it was, an awareness of the galactic center and how our periodic alignments to the galactic center transform humanity.
There's got to be some kind of major Earth changes involved once this alignment occurs. Paul LaViolette believes there's some kind of cosmic wave that is on its way, doesn't know when it's going to hit. Is there the possibility that this galactic alignment between the planet and the center of the Milky Way might also wreak some kind of major Earth changes on us, John?
Yeah, certainly. I like to think of it as the alignment is like an opening conduit. So more energy is coming in to the local system. And when more energy comes into a system, it can sort of break up or shake loose the rigid structures, you know.
Maybe earthquakes,
yeah,
things like that?
Yeah, and exactly. And but, see, it's a preparation so that the sort of Earth changes that we're experiencing, it's actually preparing the Earth to be able to hold and sustain greater energy, a greater vibration, you might say. And with that greater vibration, beings on this planet, human beings, I hope, will be vibrating at a greater level too.
There is a topic that always fascinates me, and that is that of time. Were the Mayans aware of this as well? Did they have their own views of time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they are the time-obsessed culture par excellence. I mean, it's, we hear this a lot. The amazing insight that the Maya have about time, I think, comes from their ability to transcend time. And this gets into the what we might call the metaphysics of 2012. It has to do with, you know, how everybody says 2012 is the end of time. Well, maybe. I don't believe that in a literal sense, but I believe that 2012 is a symbol for an ability that we have to end time, to transcend time. And when we do that, like the Maya did, they can look down on the historical flow and the historical processes that are unfolding on this planet and have a real insight into them as if from above. You know, they can see things as they unfold from above.
You know, I've always looked at it, John, as could it be the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end?
Yeah.
I think it's like you do. I think it's the beginning. I think it's the end of the beginning. I think it's a period of something new and enlightening. If there are Earth changes, there are Earth changes, but I do believe it's a new beginning for this planet.
Well, I think so too, and I think that, again, just drawing directly from the primary documents, the Maya creation myth, you know, the way that the world ages work, humanity always transforms itself into something new in order to survive the chaotic transformation.
Now, these alignments through the ages, this is how many ages have we been talking about here? Several of them?
Yeah, there's a total of five, and one age is like the age that ends in 2012. In the long count calendar, there's periods of baktuns. So each age, in the Mayan system anyway, each age is about 5,125 years.
How close does this echo Hopi prophecy?
Well, I think that, there might be differences in some of the number systems, you know, preferential number systems, whether mm-hmm. they're using a 7 or a 13. Of course, numbers are very important, but there might be some sort of differences in the details. But I think that the Hopi were tuned into the same information.
Let's go back, if we can, to Izapa. That seems to be, as you said, the origin of the 2012 calendar. How many different cities or civilizations did the Mayans have during that period? Because they were spread out all over the place.
Well, sure, they had many different kingdoms, and there were great Mayan cities, like I mentioned earlier, Tikal, home to some 90,000 people. Copan was another great Mayan city. Palenque, another amazing place. And then up in the Yucatan Peninsula, you had Chichen Itza and Uxmal, many different places. Izapa itself is kind of the precursor culture to the Maya. You know, many thousands of years ago in Mexico, you had the Olmec people. The Olmec civilization goes back to like 1200 BC and earlier. And the Izapan civilization grew out of that and was very brief, but it was like the real transitional culture that pioneered some of the basic institutions that the Maya civilization later adopted.
Do you believe, John, that the Maya may be descendants from Atlantis? Is that possible?
Well, I suppose that's possible. That's one way to talk about it. Sure.
The work that you've done over the years, because you've devoted many, many years to this specific area, takes you all over the country, conferences, speaking engagements. I've seen you on television before. I assume there's more. People, as we get close to this 2012 date, are beginning to become more interested, more obsessed with it, aren't they?
Yeah.
What's on your plate then?
Well, one thing I'm trying to do is to sort of facilitate, a real careful discussion around these things, and I'm interested in developments that are happening, and certainly as we get closer to 2012, there's going to be growing interest around it.
Yes.
Now, my whole perspective is that it's very important to reconstruct the original teachings and prophecy, because that is an element that doesn't seem to have survived among the Maya today, because you have to go back to this early site of Azapa and look at the carved monuments and how they're oriented to the stars and so on. And that's just the work of reconstructing this lost galactic paradigm.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, another thing that is going on today is good, really interesting developments, is that a colleague of mine in England, Jeff Stray, he runs the Diagnosis 2012 website, and that has been a pavilion of all the ideas about 2012, the whole spectrum, everything from visions and fiction and all kinds of theories and research. And he just came out with a book called Beyond 2012. And that really is, I think, a step forward in the right direction to, I really hope that a conference can happen pretty soon, like with 2012 as the specific topic.
Oh, that would be something. Indeed. Is there anything startling that came out of your research over the years that even perplexed you, shocked you?
Well, the kinds of discoveries that, you know, like, for example, the black hole material, you know, that was pretty startling.
Yeah, it is.
Because one of the things that I do in my research is I do avail myself of pretty hardcore academic research, and I enjoy doing that. And in time, what happens is you start to synthesize a big picture of everything that's going on. And that's kind of, I think, the unique thing that I have to offer is the real picture starts to coagulate. And so I think that I'm able to put some things on the table that people haven't seen before, like including scholars. And, you know, I am an independent, self-taught scholar of these cosmological systems. And I guess that we have to just think about, a lot of times the breakthroughs in a field of study come from outsiders.
Stay with us, John. We're going to take some fast blast questions for you next, because I've got a lot of them, and some of them are quite fascinating. The next hour, our final hour, will open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. John, did the Mayans have any particular belief in creation, how it may have evolved here?
Well, yeah, they do. And basically, they believe that change and, you know, creation and evolution does not happen from below, like the way that, like in Darwinian evolution, mm-hmm. that there's sort of random chance mutations and there's a buildup of processes, you know, and that sort of leads by happenstance to higher organisms and so on. The Mayan perspective is actually the opposite of that. They believe that all true change comes from above, or within, you might say. All true change begins first in the spiritual dimension, and then it sort of cascades down into the grosser planes of reality, including the level of physical reality. And so spirit animates physical forms first and foremost, and all true change comes from above.
Fast blast question here from Stephen in Boulder, Colorado. He wants to know if we experienced drastic earth changes in the past cycles.
Well, yeah, that's some of the research that's being done. A lot of like Paul LaViolette, for example, and, mm-hmm. and other researchers, they're looking at ice core samples, and there definitely seems to, the Earth is a tumultuous place, and there's been a lot of changes.
A writer from Cleveland, Ohio, wants to know if there's any tie-in with Lord Pakal, if he is involved in any of the 2012 prophecy from then?
Well, in a sense, Pakal was the great ruler of Palenque in the 7th century, and there's a famous sarcophagus lid from his tomb. And the carving on that is one of the clearest examples of how the galactic center was used by the Maya. There's a tree of life on the carving, and then there's basically you have this sacred cross tree. And in fact, in the sky, where the Milky Way crosses over the ecliptic, which is the zodiac or the path of the sun, moon, and planets, it makes a cross in the sky. And in fact, that cross targets the galactic center in Sagittarius. So Pakal is portrayed on that lid making a journey, an after-death journey into union with the center of the sacred tree cross, which was the cosmic heart and source.
Would you ever like to have lived in this era, John?
Oh, yeah, you know, in a sense, at least in my own mind, I think of, you know, there. What I sort of tune into with Mayan culture is the sector of the society that were the stargazers and the poet-philosophers, the Tlamatinime, as they would say, the poet-philosophers who would discuss metaphysics and, you know, track the movements of the stars. So at least in that sector of society, I would have liked to have lived.
Mike from San Jose, California, wants to know if you have any more examples of the Mayans' knowledge of spiritual out-of-body travels, remote viewing, and what have you.
Well, let's see. I think that is still being done a lot. Even today, the day keepers up in the highlands of Guatemala, they feel something called lightning in the blood. So this is sort of an inner intuition that they have. So like when they're doing a reading for a client, maybe they're trying to divine where a lost cow is or why a couple can't conceive or something like that. They'll count out the seeds and they'll have an intuition and a vision or a feeling. And that's one thing. I think a good answer to this question that would open up to a big thing would be that sacred plants that induce visions, shamans would use these things, and okay, they seem to have been used by the people of Izapa. We see this on some of the carvings and the way that they're portrayed, and sacred mushroom stones, for example. Mm-hmm. These ritual mushroom stones are found all over the region. So clearly the shamans of Izapa were doing some of this kind of visionary work.
A little ayahuasca, I guess, perhaps.
That's right.
Here is a interesting fast blast from Daniel, the state of Washington. Mel Gibson, he says, is working on a top-secret type film called Apocalypto, dealing with the Mayan calendar. Are you aware of it? Are you involved with it?
Well, that's very fascinating. I wish I was involved in it. There was a trailer released not too long ago, and I've been very interested in what Mel is going to do with that. And I cannot. He's keeping it pretty tightly under wraps. If anybody out there has any idea, please email me. I'd be curious to see what's going on. I think at this point, from the trailer, it seems as if the movie is limited to the adventures of a Mayan man or family within the context of a Mayan kingdom. I can't determine whether or not the conquest period is involved. It certainly doesn't seem that 2012 is involved, but only time will tell.
Are you going to go to this movie?
Oh, sure. I think that I've been very interested in how Hollywood and the media and the mass media and everything that's going on in the emergence of 2012 into sort of, you know, consciousness, cultural consciousness. I'm curious as to how the idea gets reflected and refracted as it enters mass consumption, you might say.
I bet some of it you might be shaking your head, John.
Others, well, there's a little bit
agree
of that. Yeah.
I can understand. Bruce from Phoenix, Arizona, wants to know, how did human sacrifice the Mayan cosmology intertwine. Did they do that, by the way, human sacrifice?
Yeah. The Maya, Mesoamerican culture did have different periods where they engaged in these kind of barbaric practices. Any high civilization, you'll find the whole spectrum of human genius and artistic achievement, as well as barbarism. I've really done a lot of work on this question because it is something that comes up a lot. And what I've been able to sort of separate out from the whole discussion is that as I look into spiritual traditions and I see how Mayan tradition connects with the great perennial philosophy, the great world traditions, sacrifice in spiritual traditions around the world has a certain symbolic meaning. Now, this doesn't mean human sacrifice. That, right. That would be a sort of a degraded, barbaric level of it. But in spiritual practice, it's important for a person to sacrifice or surrender, let's say, surrender their attachment to ego. And this is like in meditation practice, for example, breathing practice. It's all about meditating on letting go and disentangling oneself from the attachments to illusion. And this actually, it's an interesting how this segues with what I consider to be the big teaching or the prophecy that we find right in the Aesop and Balcourt in the creation myth story, is that it's all about how we can become freed from attachment to illusion and limitation.
Were they very, in your opinion, conscious of universal things? I guess what I'm trying to say is, I mean, did they all have this knowledge of maybe astral body projection, or was it just the shamans of the time?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm really not sure. I would think that there would have, the Mayan society was kind of, separated out into different classes of people. So I would imagine that it would have been the province of the shaman, basically. The shaman and the day keepers, the calendar priests, would have been more likely to have engaged in these kind of things. But then again, at the same time, you have clearly that Mayan kings were also doing these kind of things because they were a type of, high shaman.
They probably didn't want their populace to know, because they wanted to keep being the rulers.
Well, that could be very well be, yeah.
If there are 6 million Mayans today, what happened to the gap of what could have been a civilization that was so advanced in a number of ways? Where did we lose track here? I mean, what happened?
Well, the big thing that happened was the conquest. Going back way before the conquest,
right.
Of course, there was the classic period Maya, and that definitely had a very end terminus to it around, I guess they say around 900 AD. But, civilizations go through ebbs and flows. I mean, our own civilization had a dark age period. What if some invading force came in, during the dark ages and just sort of interfered with the whole process that was going on? We never would have had the Renaissance or the Enlightenment period. So the conquest definitely probably interfered with the natural unfolding and evolution of Mesoamerican civilization.
Brandon from Los Angeles wants to know if anybody has talked to the current Mayans about the end of the Mayan calendar or that date. Any reaction from them?
Yes, they're very interested, and they have their own sort of perspective on it, which, for example, there's a Mayan shaman daykeeper in Guatemala, Don Alejandro, and I don't know where his perspective comes from, but he has an idea about 2012 that the Earth will pass through a dark cloud for 3 days. But the dark cloud has a magnetic axis in it. And so there's going to be like a chance that everything will be, that the Earth won't come through. or there's a chance that that'll come through on the other side. So once again, and this is kind of a core teaching, I think, that I basically agree with, and a lot of sacred teachings are like this, it all always boils down to how human beings respond to the thing. It's kind of like prophecy.
Sure.
It's more like an evocation rather than something, a vision of something definitely out there in the future. Prophecy can be an evocation of the worst case scenario or our best case scenario for the future.
The calendar itself, there's no doubt that it was also created, of course, as you said, for seasons and maybe their crops and things like that. Why did they take it out so far, though, to 2012? And why does it end there? I mean, why doesn't it go on to 2050 and just keep going?
Well, basically, I believe what happened and what is responsible for 2012 being the end of a big cycle, about 2,100 years ago, at the site of Izapa, they were looking at the sky, and they had discovered that the sky slowly shifts, and this is the precession of the equinoxes. In fact, strangely, around the same time in Greece, the Greek astronomer Hipparchus was also making sky calculations, and he's credited with discovering precession in about 128 BC among the Greeks. And he did it with using star data that was only 140 years old. So precession is this vast cycle of the shifting of the sky. You know, it's basically because the Earth wobbles on its axis. So there's one complete wobble in 26,000 years. And at that time, the Azapans realized that this was happening. So the Maya were time obsessed. So they had to wrap their heads around what this was about. And what they did is they noticed that the sun was slowly shifting towards the Milky Way, the bright band of the Milky Way in the sky. And there's a diagram on the Coast to Coast website right now that illustrates that. And so they projected forward to when this great alignment in the sky was going to happen. And they thought of the alignment as Father Sun coming into union with Mother Galaxy, the Great Mother and the Great Father joining in the sky. And so they projected forward in their calculation, and their calculation is pretty much right on target, the galactic alignment in 2012.
The late Terrence McKenna was introduced your book, Maya Cosmogenesis. How did that all come about?
Well, Terrence and I were in correspondence in the early 90s. His book, written with his brother Dennis, called The Invisible Landscape, was really a landmark. It came out in 1975, and it was one of the earliest books, apart from Hamlet's Mill, that mentioned that there was going to be this rare, unusual alignment around the turn of the century. He called it around the year 2000. And then later he, in his whole theory of time, his novelty wave, which he really derived from his work with the I Ching, but strangely, the insights parallel what we're finding in Mayan cosmology. Later, he fixed it to the 2012 end date. So I've always been interested in Terrence's work and in the way that he could clearly express very complex things. So correspondence with him in the early 90s led me to look deeper into this whole thing. And, you know, the key, of course, was that this galactic alignment does happen around the Mayan end date, and that's a connection of two things, but I couldn't just let it rest with that. What I did and what I really contributed to this whole discussion is showing how this galactic alignment scenario was encoded by the Maya into their core institutions, like the sacred ball game symbolizes the alignment, or the king crowning ceremony where he takes his throne in the center of heaven. That's like the solar god taking his throne. You know, that's a symbol of the alignment as well. So there's all these different ways that this 2012 alignment was encoded into Mayan institutions. And then, of course, when Maya Cosmogenesis was being written, I asked him if he'd like to write the introduction to it.
Would you be surprised if we didn't have any major Earth changes occurring on 2012 in that period?
No, I wouldn't be surprised at all, and that's not to say that I don't think something's going on that level. It's just that, you know, to have so much expectation around a particular date, I think distracts us from being in the here and now. Like if we're future projecting to December 21st, 2012, if 2012 is about, let's say it's about like transcending time, for
all
example,
right.
and getting a glimpse of that higher wisdom, like when we can transcend time, we catch a glimpse of the higher dimensional wisdom. So if we're future projecting all the time towards this future date, it's kind of like we're missing the point. So I wouldn't be surprised if nothing happens. But then again, see, the whole thing is that it, I believe it's a process-oriented thing. We can't pin it down to one particular day or even one particular year. We're in it now. So it's really about the work of, you know, connecting with our true selves.
It's already starting, isn't it, John?
Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be back a final hour, and now we'll take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM with our special guest, John Major Jenkins. And then we'll tell you about his website, alignment2012.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Might want to take a look at that. He's done a remarkable job with that as well. We'll be back. John, your appearance, of course, on the History Channel, aren't you going to be in a documentary in January of just a few weeks away?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I went to Chichen Itza with the History Channel in September, and it's really going to be an amazing documentary. It's part of the Decoding the Past series, and I think it's probably going to air more like in mid-February, but I think it's going to be a great presentation about ideas about 2012.
Excellent. Well, let's go to the calls because they're all lining up to talk with you. We'll go to our first wild card line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. Oh,
yes,
this
sir.
Is fascinating. I missed the first part, so make sure you mention those titles of his books, particularly with Terrence doing the foreword. I mean, anything that he would contribute to, I know I'm going to love. Very great show. But I have a comment and a question. I'd like to know, and George, this is very synchronous, because just before tuning in, I picked up Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision.
Oh, sure.
So,
yeah,
so
you talk about
comment. But I want to know if he's familiar with people like Ivan Van Sertima, who, and other scholars like him, who give us a focus that we're really misaligned when we don't go both to the root of humanity in terms of coming from Africa, and also the role that the Olmecs played because certain information by seeing what they look like and the fact that they contributed to the language, you know, actually gave the Mayans the language. And lastly, I'd like to know the modern-day Mayans, how do they keep the traditions? The structures are absolutely awesome. Speak about the Temple of the Sun and the Moon, and how do they keep that knowledge and of the calendar? And I'll listen to the air. Really, really appreciate the show.
Okay, and the book that you are very interested in is called Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. We'll talk more about that this hour. Go ahead, John, if you want to come back to some of those questions.
Yeah, those are intriguing topics. I'm aware of a lot of independent research, and I think that, you know, pushing back the fringes of knowledge usually takes place by, you know, independent thinkers working on the outside. For example, Gerald Massey was a researcher who wrote in the 1880s, 1890s, and he wrote some magisterial volumes on the origin of civilization out of Africa. And he's a really, really interesting, integrative thinker. Now, the temple sites and how the modern Maya keep the knowledge, that's a good question. There has been a process of forgetting, and especially with the sort of traumatic events of the conquest, it's been sort of a difficult thing. However, there are manuscripts that preserve the sacred knowledge. The pictographic manuscripts of Mesoamerica were designed to preserve the sacred knowledge, and that's something that I've been involved in recently with my book, Pyramid of Fire, came out just last year. It has to do with the knowledge that was encoded into a pictographic manuscript that was unknown until an acquaintance of mine, Marty Matz, decoded it. He was living in Mexico in the 60s, and it was shown to him by a Mazatec shaman. So this is just one way of how the knowledge survives. And one thing about it, though, that's important to remember is that this kind of knowledge is a sacred knowledge. It's like a perennial universal wisdom. So even if that wisdom is forgotten, it's by its own very nature, being universal and eternal, those principles of spiritual growth and so on are bound to reappear at some point.
John, tell me about the cover of the Maya Cosmogenesis. It's a fascinating cover. Tell me about the theory of it and what we're looking at.
Yeah, I came up with that cover design. It's a little complex, but basically in the foreground on the lower left, we have a monument from Azapa. It's carving number 11, and that is really an amazing portrayal.
And in reality, how big is that monument?
It's about 4 feet high.
Okay.
And it basically shows, and viewers can see this on the website too, it's basically portraying the December solstice sun god in the mouth of the Milky Way. So it is literally a depiction of the 2012 alignment. And on the cover of the book, you have the alignment going on in the sky over the horizon.
What is the village there that we see?
Oh, well, that is actually, it's supposed to be Azapa, but it's a photograph that I took of a Maya site called Sayil. So for the purpose of the cover, it's just representing a temple observatory.
And is that a huge structure? Because it looks like you must have taken it from the top of a hill a long way away.
Yeah, it is a pretty big temple. Sayil in the, there's some pretty big temples there in Yucatan.
Okay, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jonathan Zapp. I was actually your guest on March 7th of this year, and John Jenkins is actually one of my closest friends.
Oh,
hi,
Jonathan.
Hey, John.
Hi.
We live close by in Colorado, and we've even toured some of the Mayan ruins together and done some DVDs together. And I've got a question for John. You've already mentioned your connection to Terrence McKenna. That's, we actually met through Terrence about a decade ago. And Terrence, in his study of the I Ching, saw that as we were traveling through time, and he felt this was mapped out in the I Ching in a kind of fractal time wave, that we were fluctuating between two great variables that he called habit and novelty. And I wonder if you could connect these variables for the listeners to the date 2012 and the cycles of time that are mapped out in the perennial philosophy.
Wow. Well, I think that Terrence's insight is really important, and that is that time, the quality of time fluctuates from day to day. So in other words, every day is not the same. And we kind of know this intuitively. We know in our own experience that, you know, some periods of time are more intense than others, you know. And so Terrence in his theory, which was based upon a numerological examination of the wave of the I Ching, he believed that time is moving towards a great singularity or concrescence, as he would call it. In other words, there will be a moment in the historical timeline when novelty, as he would say, maximizes. And in this, in his theory, then that would be like a great transformation point. Now, in his work, he did choose the date 2012 before he even knew about the Maya calendar.
This occurred, really? How about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's one of the strange synchronicities here. And then this was in the late 70s, and somebody told him, well, you know, that's when the Maya calendar, the 13 Bakhtun cycle, turns over. So in terms of how Terrence's theory relates to my own, we do share the 2012 date. My work focuses on the alignment process. So I believe that it's the change is more along the lines of a process-oriented shift, and whereas Terence's theory, the nature of the time wave, it ends precisely on December 21st, 2012.
John, the galactic alignment that we're talking about that occurs every 26,000 years, does modern science agree with that?
Yeah. There's an astronomer, Jean Mius. He's a European astronomer, very respected. He actually calculated it in his book, Mathematical Astronomy Morsels. And, you know, so it is a real astronomical process. And I've taken a very close look at it. And, you know, astronomers and scholars don't really have much to say about it.
All right, next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with John Major Jenkins on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Oh, sure can.
This is Ronnie from Hershey. I listen to your show a lot, George, and tonight I just had to call. I'm a stargazer myself. I have studied astronomy. I have a degree in biology. And right now I want to bring you all up to the present because we are going to lose 1 minute of time at the end of this year, 2005. And the closer we get to the center of the Milky Way galaxy, the Earth is actually slowing down. This is why we're losing 1 minute of time from our year.
That's pretty dramatic, isn't it? One minute or one second?
Well, this has been published. We are going to be losing time. The closer we get, well, my own theory is the closer we get to the center, the Earth is slowing down, because if you visualize the whole galaxy as a swirl, like a big giant donut with a hole in the middle, the closer you get to the center, you slow down. This is with anything. And the further out you are, the faster you're going. We are losing time, and it's starting now. This year, the atomic clocks are going to be adjusted 1 minute behind.
All right. Now, John, you think it's a second. So we got to...
It might be a second. But
okay.
We are losing time. Now, next year, we will lose more time. And up to 2012, we will be losing time. And also, because of the Earth slowing down, when you asked about earthquakes and volcanoes, etc., the Earth is adjusting. The Earth, as a living thing, is adjusting to this slowdown and this coming to the center of the galaxy, and it is going to be producing earthquakes and volcanic action, and there's going to be other tsunamis, etc., because of this slowdown effect.
Okay, well, let's get your reaction to that. Thanks, Ronnie. And it is 1 second, not 1 minute. John, you are correct there.
Yeah, I'd heard about that a couple of weeks ago. That's a fascinating thing. It's not surprising. The Earth is generally slowing down. The rotation of the Earth on its axis, we call it 24 hours, but over, you know, many, many hundreds and thousands of years, the Earth is gradually slowing down. And as Romy said, it seems to be entrained to the larger process of our movements through the galaxy. And I think that she's right on target there with, you know, the angular momentum is what they would call it. You know, the spinning of the Earth, the crust of the Earth and the liquid magma inside of the Earth is all going to be shifting and going through changes as the Earth slows down.
All right, first-time caller line, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Kent from Austin.
Hi, Kent. Go ahead, sir.
Y'all have kind of touched on it a little bit. Did I understand that the Mayans made the prediction from the first century B.C.?
Yes.
Okay, it's been a while since I've looked at the timeline, but how did they get from B.C. to 2012 A.D.?
You mean just calculating forward some 2,000 years? Can you go a little bit further into the question?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been in a class, but when people were living in the time of B.C., were they counting the years backwards to the time of Christ?
Well, we do in our current calendar. We, you know, the calendar that we have, you know, B.C., the Maya would have placed themselves in the seventh baktun of their time system.
Did they, John, come up with the date 2012, or did we interpret it to be 2012?
Right. Well, sure. Basically, 2012 is in our own calendar system. So when scholars correlated the Maya calendar with our own Gregorian calendar, then we're able to label it 2012. But
okay.
The long count system operates in its own sort of methodology.
Could it be off by a few years?
No, because that's the correlation question. And scholars have looked at that very carefully, and they were able to figure out exactly how the Maya calendar correlates with our own because of star positions and moon positions on the monuments, as well as like carbon-14 dating. So that was a real big effort by scholars working over 20, 30, 40 years. And so, yeah, the whole question of is it really December 21st, 2012? That's an important question. And I have documents on my website that they're sort of like support files for some of these questions that come up.
It's a good time for you to mention the name of all your books because people want to know them.
Well, the Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 came out in 1998. That's the one that Terrence McKenna wrote the introduction to. And then the follow-up was Galactic Alignment, the Transformation of Consciousness, according to Mayan, Egyptian, and Vedic traditions, came out in 2002. That was like the follow-up book. So it really looks at Mithraism and the Hindu tradition and Egypt and so on. The recent book came out last year. It's called The Pyramid of Fire, which is about this unknown Aztec manuscript that my friend Marty Matz transcribed at the behest of his Mazatec teacher, and it contains spiritual teachings about the end of time, the spiritual ascent at the end of time.
Does anything talk about God or you know, Jesus at all? I'm curious to see if they were aware of that too.
Well, in a sense, Quetzalcoatl is a deity figure in Mesoamerica that it goes through a very similar process that Jesus went through in terms of a rebirth or a resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really an important sort of archetype. And that's where I look when I'm looking for teachings or prophecies about what 2012 is about.
Because it could be one and the same, right? Possible?
Well, on a symbolic level, I think, but yeah. I mean, you mean Quetzalcoatl and Jesus, one and the same person?
Yeah, one and the same, yeah.
Well, I suppose on a sort of a symbolic or archetypal level, it certainly seems to be manifesting the same sort of principle of resurrection, and which is just to say that it's about the second birth or the birth of the initiatory birth of a person into reconnection with God or the higher wisdom.
What's the time period of Quetzalcoatl's existence?
He first emerges in about the 2nd century AD at Teotihuacan in central Mexico. But there's a lot of mystery around this figure because it seems like he was a historical person, but then he also has these sort of deity-like qualities as well.
Did he just appear on the scene?
I have a cosmological theory about Quetzalcoatl in terms of his astronomical references, and I go into that in my book, Maya Cosmogenesis. Like many of the deities in Mesoamerica, their processes and their stories, their mythologies are encoding astronomical movements and astronomical events, while at the same time they provide spiritual teachings.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls in a moment. And welcome back. John Major Jenkins, our guest, and your phone calls. Back to the calls we go. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Very, very interesting show today. I'm really glad that I'm listening. There are a few dots that I'm connecting here, and I was hoping the guest could sort of draw a picture that I'm creating. I'm noticing the number 26,000. And for one thing, that's we're nearing the end of the 26,000-year cycle. Also, I looked on the NASA website. We're 26,000 years, light years from the center of the galaxy, and there's a precession of 26,000 years. And so I was just hoping that the guest can illuminate that.
Yeah. You're touching upon something that's intrigued me for a while. I have a chapter in my book, Galactic Alignment, where I go into this. It is a strange, call it a coincidence, or maybe it's a pointer to something more interesting, that we are basically about 26,000 light years from the center of the galaxy. And precession, the wobble of the Earth on its axis, the Earth wobble, is 26,000 years. Now, when I was looking at this information on all of this, I discovered a principle of subatomic physics. It's called proton precession. And the rate of a proton's precession will be directly related to the strength of the magnetic field that it's in, as well as its distance from the source of that magnetic field. Now, if the galactic center is the source of a magnetic field, which it is, we are in the field of the galaxy, then there does seem to be some kind of entrainment or relationship between the distance and the rate of precession. So I think that the caller's onto something there, and it would seem to me that scientists should know about these kind of things should get on it right away.
I think so, too. West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hello.
Hey, my name is Barbara. I'm calling from Gardena.
Hi, Barbara.
For your guest, I saw a special a couple of times on the Maya, and at the end of that special, a Mayan guide says, one of these days they're going to ask us, talking about the archaeologists, what this all means. So what I want to know is how much of information is available from indigenous sources as opposed to the non-indigenous interpretations of the Maya script.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the end date information, that is a tradition that was fragmented and lost even before the conquest. This tradition goes back, some 2,000 years. And my first approach to trying to understand something about 2012 was to look at, modern ethnographic accounts that were being gathered, reports from modern medicine men and wise men of the Maya. And unfortunately, there was really nothing there to be found about that was saying anything about 2012. Now, we have the creation myth, the Popol Vuh, or Hero Twin creation myth, that was recorded in the 1550s. So in a sense, that is an account or a record that was recorded by Mayan elders at that time. And that is very insightful. That actually provides us with the teaching about what happens at the end of the age. And the creation myth is one of my primary sources that I use. And my work, of course, is involved in reconstructing the cosmology, and by necessity, that's it's necessary to sort of go back and piece things together in sort of an archaeological way.
Okay, thanks for the response and for the question. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, my name is Richard from California.
Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Just calling in to talk to John. I was present at the 2004 Signs of Destiny. With Arguelles and you as a keynote. And I was fascinated by the whole conversations that took place there and everything. And Since I've left, you know, my the main question I kind of left with was kind of like a maybe like a synthesis question of how to synthesize Dr. Arguelles' work with your work, or kind of more like how would you approach his you know, his work, and as far as the work you've done, and you know, because your work is very scholarly, very how can I say, professional and accurate as far as dating and history and all that. So how do you look at like a work like Dr. Jose Arguelles'
John? Who is he? Want to explain who that doctor is for us?
Jose Arguelles is an author and a visionary who wrote the book The Mayan Factor. And that was kind of a breakthrough book in 1987. He was also involved in the coordination of the harmonic convergence event that happened in that year. Since then, he's written a few other books, and he has put forward a system of his own sort of modeling that's based on the Maya calendar system. It's called Dream Spell, the Dream Spell system. And there's I believe that I like to make a distinction. There's visionary work being done that sort of strives to like model the Mayan calendar in different ways, but there's a lot of sort of like personal model making that goes into some of these systems. And I've always been interested in critiquing research and books that come out, and I think it's important to do that as we are trying to understand more deeply what the Maya calendar is really about. We should be having conversations with each other and, you know, debating the points of you know, that are being brought out. Now, one of the, you know, early critiques of Arguelles' system that I had was that the day count that he was using was of his own invention. And it was out of synchronization with the traditional authentic surviving day count from the highlands of Guatemala. And I thought that that was a point that needed to be brought out and, you know, looked at clearly. So, and another thing is, this is all part of the 2012 phenomenon where there's going to be a whole spectrum of writings and research and, you know, visionary ideas and dreams and novels.
It's going to be like Y2K almost all over again, John.
A whole spectrum of things, and I think that Jeff Stray, with his book Beyond 2012, has really done something amazing in terms of pulling it all together and sort of explaining all this whole wide range of ideas in a really clear way. And one more thing real quick is that was a really important conference that took place. Chet Snow put that on in Tempe last year, and I do have the 3-DVD set from that conference available on my website.
Okay, which again is alignment2012.com?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. East of the Rockies, your turn. Hi there.
Nighthawk.
Yes, sir.
Hey.
Anybody who says Nighthawk remembers me from my old St. Louis shows.
Indeed. I have one of these petroglyph sites here. It's fully open to the west, so I can follow the setting sun all along the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
There must be the Mayan calendar has to work in somehow the lunar cycle.
Yeah.
That runs on, I think, a 19-year cycle.
Yep.
I have no idea. I can't get to the cave myself now to try and watch for these alignments at this point as far as other where things are actually fixed on the petroglyph stone.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. You know, I don't know if you can get online, but there's a archaeoastronomer named Nal Morris, N-A-L Morris, and he has a whole method for calibrating these petroglyph sites. He lives out in Utah, And I think there's a lot of archaeoastronomy going on, especially in the Rockies. And I don't know, what state are you in?
He's in Illinois.
Oh, in Illinois, okay.
Yeah.
So it's a petroglyph site in Illinois. Interesting.
Lots of things in Illinois.
You should try to get there on an equinox or a solstice and just sort of look to see where the sun is on the horizon and see if there's any important lining up points.
A lot of people, by the way, on the 21st, get together and converge themselves. They've been doing that for years. It's almost become almost like a fad to do that.
Well, it's a natural energy shift point in the year, and of course, even Christmas and the New Year's celebration is based upon the winter solstice as being a time of renewal. And the way you started out your show tonight, George, had to do with New Year's resolutions.
Yes.
People still intuitively feel that it's the time to sort of let go of the old year and to make goals and commitments and envision what you want your highest sort of potential to be in the new cycle.
Let go of the old, bring in the new. First time caller line, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Bob. I'm from Texas.
Hi, Bob.
I have a quick question
ahead,
for sure. Mr. Jenkins.
Uh-huh.
And I'll take my
go.
Answer off the air.
Okay.
Now, in 2012, in this galactic alignment, do you think any other planets will be visible, like, that we've never seen before?
I don't think so. You know, there's a whole theory by the Binary Research Institute that our sun is part of a binary star system. And that's a pretty intriguing theory. It's based upon some ancient documents and so on. But the alignment itself is really an alignment of the entire frame of our solar system and how it lines up with the galactic center. So, no, I don't think that the alignment itself is going to uncover any other planets in our solar system.
All right, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello to the
yes.
both of you.
Thank you.
My name is Mary. I'm calling from the state of Washington. And I was wondering if your guest there has heard about a book called Quest for the Lost City by Dana and Ginger Lamb.
No, I have not.
Okay. It's I came across the book actually from meeting Dana when I lived in the state of New Mexico. His wife had already passed on, and it's been so long since I read the book, I really can't remember a lot about it. I do remember, and their car broke down, and they walked in to the jungles down there.
Oh,
and,
I am familiar
remember
with that book.
Them.
Yes, that's an amazing book. I do. You've jogged my memory, Mary,
right.
And that is I think it had to do with They took a journey down to the Chiapan rainforest.
Yeah, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah.
And they stumbled into it, huh?
They went into the jungle, and they went around on forest paths, and they actually uncovered some previously unknown Mayan ruins there.
All right. Well, it's been going on for a long time. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Arlene, and I'm calling from Canyon City, Colorado.
Hello, Arlene. Go ahead.
I have a question for your guest. Discovery had a program on within the past year on the aging of God. Have you found any indication in the Mayan cosmology of a new perspective on the nature of that which we call God? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, that is a deep question, Mr. Jenkins.
That is a very deep question. What I see at Azapa especially is that there was a new revelation about the nature of deity. In other words, at Azapa, you have alignments to the Big Dipper, which was Seven Macaw, the vain and false ruler of the previous world age. And that was the polar god. But then with this whole alignment cosmology that they were projecting forward to, they realized that there was this larger perspective. And so they realized that God would no longer be the vain and false ruler, Seven Macaw. In other words, and that's really a perennial truth, that at the end of a cycle, egoism is running rampant. It's ruling and ruining the planet. And this is really what I call the prophecy of 2012, and you find it right on the monuments of Azapa. It's right in the creation myth. So the old God is exposed as being false, and the new deity is the one that aligns us truly with our higher wisdom, our true selves. And that's really what the 2012 alignment is about in terms of a spiritual teaching.
Do you believe the Maya has, that they perhaps had the most influence on our future than other past civilizations?
Well, I think that the Mayan civilization does have a very special kind of providence in how its wisdom is, it promises to integrate with the momentum of our own Western civilization. Like, it's almost like the scientific method and the shadow side of Western civilization, it's kind of run its course. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that the Mayan civilization can offer some long-needed new wisdom to Western thinkers.
But you do not believe in the doomsday catastrophe theories?
No, I do not believe that. I don't believe that because in the primary documents, like the creation myth, it's always about transformation. Now, nothing's graven in stone, and each person's experience will be different. What it sort of boils down to in terms of how, you know, two people in the exact same place can be experiencing that place in completely opposite ways, depending on where they're at internally. So it's always about whether we choose fear or we choose openness, or say love. Openness to the unknown or fear of the unknown.
John, circle the calendar, December 21st, 2012. You're going to be on Coast to Coast.
All right.
Appreciate you being on the show, and you have a good new year, John Major Jenkins.
Thank you, George.
This guy knows his Mayan civilization information, doesn't he? For Dan Galante, Nikki Imbrunoni, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, you have a happy new year, everyone. Until then, be safe.